T-minus 15 seconds.
Ready. Roger.
15 seconds.
11.
11.
10. 9. 8. 7. 6. 5. 4. 3. 2. We have liftoff of NASA's New Horizons spacecraft.
Revelations of New Horizons may help us to understand better how our solar system was formed.
Hi folks, this is Brian May and you're listening to Blue Dot with Dave Schlom.
Aw, thanks Brian. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. Brian May is world famous as the guitarist for Queen. He's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and his team's film, Bohemian Rhapsody, is up for 5 Oscars at the Academy Awards. But he's also a serious scientist and a member of the New Horizons science team. Earlier this year, when New Horizons flew by a bizarre Kuiper Belt object called Ultima Thule, May was there and even wrote a song about it. So I reached out to our good friend Alan Stern, who just happens to be the principal investigator for New Horizons, to invite him and May on to talk about not just the flyby, but their amazing collaboration on the New Horizons team. They both gracefully accepted, and they join us via Skype, Stern from Boulder, Colorado, and May from his home in London, where he assures me he wore his best frock for our interview. I hope it looks good on radio. Alan Stern and Brian May, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks very much.
Dave. Yeah, great being here.
I'd like to start out with, how did you two meet? When did your relationship begin?
Alan.
Brian.
You start. The boss should start.
Brian, around the time of the Pluto flyby, my recollection is Brian made contact through a third party in the public affairs chain in NASA and asked if he could come by after the flyby. I think you were tied up at the exact day of flyby with an animal rights event.
Yeah.
And so Brian came by our mission control and met our science team and others on the mission team. And we really hit it off. And then he said to me a couple days later, you know, I'm just so taken with the science. Is there any way that I can pitch in? And I made him a mission collaborator on the mission science team. And he has been pitching in more and more with each passing year. And now with the results from Ultima Thule, Brian is in the conversation virtually every day, moving the science along with us.
Yeah, they can't shut me up now. It's a big mistake putting me on the email list, I think. I love it. I do love it. It's terrifying, though, the amount of stuff that comes through. I have a real problem keeping up. But my God, it's exciting as these images are coming down live from the New Horizons probe. It's absolutely enthralling to be a part of that.
Well, you know, it dawned on me last night, you know, thinking about talking to you two this morning. Of course, New Horizons' original purpose was the first flyby of Pluto back in July of 2015. And a lot of us, you know, remember that. I think, Alan, you may have some vague memories of what that was like. But, you know, today's a special day that we're doing this interview. This is the day on February 18th, 1930, that Clyde Tombaugh discovered Pluto.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely right. You know, thanks for bringing that up, too. Really, I think people don't appreciate the magnitude of what Clyde did in that discovery. You know, beyond discovering a new planet, he really discovered the third zone of our solar system. And he was so far ahead of his time that even though others looked out beyond Pluto, all across the 40s and 50s, all across the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they found nothing. And it was only in the 1990s that the Kuiper Belt was discovered. That's the context for Pluto. The other dwarf planets that are out there and all the myriad smaller bodies like Ultima Thule. He was two generations ahead of his time. Really a stunning achievement.
Oh, it's an amazing thing. I was lucky enough to visit the telescope that he discovered Pluto on. And you realize it's very primitive. And it was very difficult to be stuck there all night looking at these plates. And it's a hard, I have a hard job figuring out if he was extremely lucky or if he was extremely skillful, but I think both, because that was incredibly hard. He was looking in the right place for the wrong thing, in a sense, wasn't he, Alan?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right, Brian. When the search was started back at the turn of the 20th century by Percival Lowell and others, they thought that the measurements of the orbit of Uranus indicated that there was another giant planet beyond Neptune. There probably is, but it's not the one that Clyde found or that anybody's found since. But, you know, speaking of this luck thing, a lot of discoveries, you know, you make your own luck. And Clyde, absolutely, you know, he did the whole project. When they brought him to Lowell, his job was to design the search technique, and he invented a completely new one, which we use today. It's how we found Ultima Thule and how almost everything in the outer solar system is found. He invented that. And then he took all the data. He went to the telescope and made the photographs of the sky. He analyzed all the data himself. He did the entire project himself. And most amazing to me is that if you've ever looked at those plates, you know, some of them contain hundreds of thousands of stars on them and scads of asteroids scooting across that are other moving targets in the foreground. Never once in the year that he was searching before he found Pluto did he ever go to his boss, the director of Lowell Observatory, and with a false alarm. The first time he knocked on the boss's door, he'd found it.
Amazing.
Do you remember who the boss was then?
Yes. Actually, a quite accomplished astronomer, Vesto Slipher.
I remember that name. That is like the most cosmic sounding name for an observatory director.
Yeah. They have since named that building the Vesto Slipher Building. At Lowell Observatory, he had many contributions of his own in galactic and extragalactic astronomy.
Well, let's talk about the recent flyby, Ultima Thule. How was it decided after the Pluto flyby? Take us through what the process was for coming up with the next target.
Sure. Well, let's start at the very beginning. I'll be brief, but when NASA called for proposals to fly the mission to explore Pluto, they required that all the proposing teams demonstrate that their spacecraft would have the capabilities to go on and explore the Kuiper Belt as well. And the National Academy of Sciences insisted on that in the decadal survey that promoted this to top of the heap for funding priority back in the early 2000s. So we had to include the fuel, the communications range, the power, the ability for our instruments to work in the fainter light levels way beyond Pluto, all that in the design of the spacecraft. So this was baked into the cake from the beginning. But NASA, when we were awarded the project over our competitors back at the end of 2001, the NASA award letter made clear that Pluto was the main target and that the Kuiper Belt mission would only be approved for funding later based upon the success at Pluto, you know, and how good a shape the spacecraft was in. Because who knew in 2001, you know, how New Horizons would be doing in late 2015. So after the exploration of Pluto, we had already found several possible flyby targets, ones that we could reach within the amount of fuel we had left, about a half a tank, sat down as a science team and chose the one that we call Ultima Thule. And I could tell you why we chose that one later if you want, but we took it to NASA. They completely agreed with our rationale for why this one, not another one, and then approved us to go ahead and do the targeting burns with the propulsion system to head off in that direction.
Ultima Thule is a really cool name. What does it mean?
It's a Latin phrase. Thank you. We had a naming contest that was suggested by someone in the public and got top votes. And it means beyond the known world or beyond the farthest frontiers, which very nicely captures the spirit of exploration and what we're actually doing. Because the exploration of Ultima Thule is the farthest exploration in the history of humankind in terms of actually visiting a place. Now, to be clear, the Voyagers are further out, but they're out in the wilderness. This is the farthest flyby that's ever been conducted, the farthest space exploration that's ever been conducted of any worlds.
And you also gave Brian an interesting task. Could you tell us about asking him to make a video about this?
Well, a song, really, right? And then a video, I guess.
You know, it wasn't really a task like an assignment. We were emailing this past summer, and as I was putting together plans for what NASA calls a communication plan, but what I just call our public engagement, I had the idea that since Chuck Berry had played famously at the 1989 encounter of Voyager with Neptune, that since Brian was coming to the flyby, perhaps he could play something or even write something. And I dashed off an email about that. And I guess I should let Bri pick it up from there.
Yeah, I kind of gasped thinking, how am I going to write a song to rhyme something with Ultima Thule? And so I went away scratching my head, but with the will. And then something happened to me. I don't know. I kind of woke up with this feeling that this wasn't just about this particular part of this mission. This was about exploration. And it was the continuation of that spirit of adventure and discovery, which in a sense defines the human race, whether it's Columbus or whether it's putting a man on the moon or whatever. You know, this is the farthest that man has ever seen and encountered an object. And that's what I wrote the song about. So, the name of the mission is New Horizons, which really sums it up. You know, we're looking for new horizons for mankind the whole time. And this is it, folks. You know, I'm in awe of what these people have done. This is really very comparable with landing a man on the moon all that time ago. There isn't a man in this or a woman in this craft, but it's been guided 4 billion miles away to an accuracy of about, 500 miles, 50 miles? Also, you have cameras and various other spectrometers and machines on this thing, and they all have to be aimed precisely at a distance of 4 billion miles. So it's extraordinary that this all worked out, and they got these wonderful pictures back of this completely unknown object. Yeah. So that's what my song's about. It's about the unlimited curiosity and ability to achieve of humankind.
And the video is really cool. It's also got Stephen Hawking in it.
It has. Yeah. At the last minute, I discovered I was looking for something to kind of set it off in terms of text. And I discovered, actually, my collaborator, Claudia Mansoni, discovered a little video which Stephen had made to congratulate Alan and his team in 2015, when they actually did rendezvous with Pluto. And Stephen said these great things. He says, we explore because we need to know. And he also said the New Horizons missions will throw new light on how we came into existence. Now, this is a big thing. You're looking at a primeval object here, which was formed at the dawn of the solar system and hasn't really been messed with since then. So we're looking at the very material from which life emerged. So something very exciting can be learned from all this.
Well, Alan, that's amazing to me to think you can just, you know, jot off an email to Brian May and he'll write a song for you. What was it like when you first heard it?
Well, first of all, it was amazing to me that Brian even considered doing it. I thought he would be far too busy, but I felt compelled to ask. And, you know, Brian was very collaborative about this when he decided to go ahead and do it, as he just described, a month or maybe it was a month or 2 months later. He began by saying, I have an idea and I'm going to put some lyrics on paper and I'd like your comments. Mm-hmm. And then he iterated on the lyrics and then he started to think about how he wanted to back it and then went into studio to do some preliminary things. At every step, he was sending me recordings and changed lyrics and things and saying, what do you think? And I was so honored to be a part of that process, to work with Brian not just scientifically as we have on New Horizons, but, you know, on a piece of music. I think we went back and forth dozens of times in the end before it finally debuted. And even at the stage of recording it, he was sending practice tracks and things.
Yeah, we had fun. We had a now famous interchange because I actually I was collaborating. I hope you don't mind me telling this story, Alan.
I wasn't going to bring it up.
Well, I was writing the lyrics with a famous lyric writer over here called Don Black, who goes back way, way to James Bond and before. And Don Black had contributed part of the lyric, and he'd said, we're off to New Horizons and God is at the wheel. So I demoed this for Alan, and Alan said, I don't think we really want God at the wheel. You know, it's us at the wheel. I don't want people to feel that we're reliant on an exterior control mechanism or being. So I wandered around for about 3 weeks with this problem in my head. And at one point I wanted to put Alan at the wheel because I thought Alan is at the wheel. He's the boss. But Alan went, no, I'm not having that. And so eventually we ended up with Hold On to the Wheel, which makes sense because it's a way of tying the whole thing up. But those are the kind of interchanges we had. And it was very fruitful for me. I was writing this as a tribute to these guys, and particularly to Alan and his team, apart from the whole network of NASA and the whole spirit, as I say, of space exploration.
Well, I believe it was Apollo 8 where they said Isaac Newton was at the wheel.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. He doesn't rhyme very well, though, does he?
No. Well, so I'm thinking producer credit for the next Grammys for best science content rock song.
I tell you what, I've got loads of awards on my mantelpiece, but I've never had a Grammy. They never felt in their hearts that they wanted to give us one. So that would be a first for me.
Well,
we will get the Oscars next week, though, and see what happens there. Boy, oh boy.
Good luck with that. Yes.
I have a scoop. Do you want a scoop?
Sure.
We are actually going to open the show. We're going to play for 3 minutes, 30 seconds at the opening of the Oscars, which has just been released as a piece of information. So I will be there rehearsing in a couple of days' time.
Well, if I wasn't going to watch the Oscars before, I sure am now.
Good. So we will hope to smash it.
Oh, I'm sure you will. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll return to our conversation with Brian May and Alan Stern from the New Horizons mission to Pluto, Ultima Thule, and beyond. You are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with Brian May and Alan Stern. Let's talk some more about Ultima Thule and the flyby. And Brian, I'd like to know, what was it like for you to actually be there when all this was going on around New Year's?
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you. I have a bit of this imposter syndrome thing. There's a piece of me which thinks, am I really worthy to be here? You know, I'm not a professional scientist. I'm kind of on the periphery. I'm a collaborator, and I get a bit of that, you know, maybe I shouldn't be here. Maybe I shouldn't be making any noise. But writing the song gave me a good reason to be there and do this thing. And we premiered the song and the video that night. I think it was just after midnight on New Year's Eve. What an amazing spot to have. And so I felt like I was a part of it. And that kind of warms my heart. I like to feel that I am a part of it. The music is one thing. The other thing which draws me in is the stereoscopy. And stereoscopy 3D, if you like, is something which has been my passion for so many years, ever since I was, you know, 7 or 8. So, and what I bring, or what part of what I bring to the New Horizons team, is messing about with images to find the stereoscopic magic. Now, they already have a stereo guru there. Paul Schenk is a worldwide expert on this stuff. But I just chuck in some stuff now and again, and this is wonderful for me. This is participation. And when you see some of these images in 3D for the first time, genuine 3D, because you have a proper baseline, it's a stunning thing. So I've been hawking my owls around there. Alan's people now have lots of my stereoscopic viewers, which we call the owl. So every time one of these things comes up and we have a stereoscopic image, everyone can see it and go, wow. And that makes me happy.
Hey, Alan, David.
Yeah.
Can I chip in on this?
Sure. I was just going to ask you what, and you can add what you want, but I'm curious from you, you know, can you explain to us what's the value of these stereoscopic images when you're studying a planetary body?
Well, that's perfect. That's precisely what I wanted to chip in. You know, I think to a lot of people, certainly in the lay public, maybe not your listeners, but in the lay public, a lot of people will think of stereo as just a kind of a fun thing that you do because it looks 3D. And they don't think of it as an actual useful scientific product. But it's through stereo that we produce all of the topographic maps of the objects that we fly by, and knowing what's up and what's down, what's a hole in the ground and what's a mountain, and many other things, is fundamental to the geophysics and the geology, and even to our understanding of the atmosphere of Pluto, in Pluto's case, knowing the topography. And so this stereo that Brian brings to the table, the techniques that he uses are different than Paul's. And actually, when Brian offered to do that kind of work for the team, I thought, well, this is just perfect because it's one of the few areas where we didn't have multiple people with the same expertise so that we could really hammer out and debate issues. Paul's, as Brian said, world class and recognized. He's on so many missions because he's so talented at this. But having somebody using a completely independent set of techniques and bouncing things off one another has turned out to really have strengthened our team, and I give Brian the credit for that.
How did you first get interested in stereoscopic viewing? Because this is something that's really a passion of yours. How'd you first get interested in that?
I was a kid opening my packet of Weetabix. This is the kind of cereal we had in those days, and we still do. And in your Weetabix packet, if you were lucky, you would get a toy or a card or something. And one day out of this Weetabix packet popped a little card with two pictures of a hippopotamus on, side by side, very flat, very kind of uninteresting looking. But it said on the back, send away 1 and 6 pence and a packet top to get the stereo viewer, which is what I did. And I put the card in the viewer when it arrived in the mail, and suddenly, instead of looking at two flat pictures, I was looking through a window at a live hippopotamus, and I could almost smell his breath. It was so real. So I was absolutely knocked out, and I just wondered. I remember wondering at that time, why doesn't everybody do this the whole time? If you can make pictures like this that are 3D and so real, why would you bother making flat pictures? And that stayed with me my whole life, and I find that people like me who are bitten by the stereoscopic bug, that's the way they are. Forever afterwards, they're looking for opportunities to see things in stereo, as we do in real life every second of the day. That's the way life is arranged around us. We have this wonderful ability of stereopsis, because we have two eyes instead of one, of seeing depth instantaneously. So that's what you're reproducing with a stereo picture, reality.
And, you know, it's funny, when you were describing that so beautifully, it made me think about, and I don't know anything about music, so this may make no sense at all, but it does to me. When I try to think of describing the Brian May guitar sound, it's so unique, and it almost has this stereoscopic 3D aural feel to it when you listen to your guitar. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but that's how it seems to me.
Yeah, well, it's very comparable, of course. We get stereo vision. We also have stereo sound. We have two ears and two eyes, and it's a very similar thing. And our eyes perceive sound waves with slightly differing wave fronts depending on where our ears are situated. And yes, you get a 3D picture in sound. And that's what stereo is all about. And that's what surround sound is all about, taking it to a step further. And Queen and myself mixing the guitars would always mix them so you're immersed in them, so that the guitars are all around you. I have to be honest, I learned that from Jimi Hendrix. Wow. And the Beatles.
Wow.
To be immersed in the sound.
Well, those are two pretty incredible sets of artists to copy or be influenced by. That also makes me wonder about, both of you have interesting formative experiences growing up. I know Alan got interested in the space program, and there's a famous story about him seeing an Apollo flight manual that Walter Cronkite was waving across the television, and then he wanted to get one. And went through a lot to do that. And so I was just wondering about some of your formative experiences. Were you interested in the space program when you were a kid?
Yeah, I was. I remember where I was when the moon landing happened. I am old enough to remember that. I was down in Cornwall with my drummer's mum watching a tiny little TV screen. And there was Neil Armstrong going down the ladder and saying, "This is one small step for a man and one giant step for mankind." And it's indelibly carved in my brain. Yes. And I was always into astronomy because of somebody who you probably never heard of called Patrick Moore.
Oh, yes. I read all of Patrick Moore's books as a kid.
Okay, well, he was my inspiration. I used to beg my parents to be allowed to stay up and watch his program called The Sky at Night at 10 o'clock. And he's kind of the inspiration for a whole, well, more than probably two or three generations of astronomers in the UK. I was lucky enough to get to know him later on in life, and he became my kind of surrogate uncle. And it was Patrick who persuaded me to go back and get my PhD, which I'd abandoned in 1972 when Queen started to happen. So I went back and I got my doctorate. And that really opened the doors to getting back into astronomy. And I've loved it ever since.
Alan, anything you want to add to that?
I think that's a beautiful, beautiful tale. I didn't know it. I was a bit younger. I was really a boy when all this was taking place. And, you know, I can remember the first Apollo moon landing, watching it with my parents, you know, in my childhood home. But I had already been hooked on space exploration, I think, since I was about 7 or 8, and I'd read I was kind of a pest at the library. I'd read every book they had and wrote countless letters to NASA asking for information and all of that. And, it's all I ever wanted to do. So, I was very fortunate to be able to grow up and live my dream.
Well, Brian, you brought back memories for me, because that just triggered a whole flood of memories of going riding my 10-speed bicycle to the Northridge branch of the Los Angeles Public Library, and I would raid the astronomy and space section. And it was Patrick Moore's book, his books, that got me really turned on to astronomy as a kid.
Wow. Amazing. Small world, huh?
Yeah. Well, back to Ultima Thule. I saw just this week some really interesting stuff about, it's got the strangest shape. Could you guys describe what you found about it? Just give us a sense of what you thought it looked like going in, and now what we know it looks like, because it's strange.
Bri, why don't you go first?
Oh, I was going to say you should go first, because I'm the amateur. You're the boss.
He's the stereo man.
Amateur means love, so you go first.
Okay, well, I think it's astonishing to everyone who's been involved, and it played a little trick on us, because these guys already knew roughly. They expected it to look like two objects stuck together, a bilobate object. And there are a few of them in the solar system, so it seemed, and there may be more to discover. But when we got the first pictures of them, it looked like two spheres stuck together, one big one and one little one. So everyone kind of jumps to the conclusion, starts making the models of this object, which is like a big ball and a little ball. But it played a trick, because the particular aspect it had shown to us, it could have been that shape. But as soon as we saw a bit of turning, we realized that it actually wasn't that shape at all. And the bigger sphere was very flattened, more flattened, much more flattened than a rugby ball or American football, if you like, kind of almost a pancake shaped. And we had just been presented with something that looked like a ball. And the smaller one is also flattened to a different extent, but it's a completely different object once you realize what it looks like in 3D. So I don't know if you agree with me, Alan, but it was an extraordinary trick to play on us, and I don't think anyone was prepared, right?
Ryan's absolutely right. When we started to get the later images that revealed, you know, looking around the corner and seeing a bit of the backside of Ultima Thule, our jaws were on the ground, because we never in space exploration, comets had been seen to be bilobate, but we didn't know if that was something that was created by all the cometary activity and the erosion of ices and so forth that takes place when these objects come close to the sun, or if that's how they were originally shaped, maybe only accentuated by those erosive processes. But here we're seeing something really in the wild. Ultima Thule has never been close to the sun. It's been out at this great deep freeze 4 billion miles away ever since its birth. And so its shape and its other characteristics are primordial. And that's the value in Ultima Thule to understanding the origin of things, like the origin of planets, out of which smaller bodies like Ultima Thule, they are built. So the bilobate shape wasn't very much of a surprise, as Brian said, but the flattening was unlike anything that we had seen in the outer solar system before, and took us by surprise. For a matter of a week or two, we were double and triple checking all of the data that went into this discovery. And now we have a lot of explaining to do, and not just the New Horizons team, but the planetary science community has to take this as information about the formation processes that were going on out there at this great distance, and how you can form these objects with these kinds of shapes. And there are lots of ideas right now, but they're confounded by the fact that in addition to having a strange shape, the polar axis, the axis around which Ultima Thule spins, is not north-south in the solar system, as you would most simply expect it would be from the formation of bodies from a disk of material around the sun, a thin disk that would have all of its angular momentum in the plane of the disk, and that would tend to put the polar axes north and south. Instead, the polar axis of Ultima Thule is pointed almost 90 degrees to that. It's pointed back at the direction of the sun. So when we came up to it, it was sort of spinning with its axis pointed sort of towards the spacecraft, since we're coming out of the direction of the sun, and a bit like a propeller. And we couldn't see what was on the far side of that propeller. But the shape is a maybe one of the biggest findings that we've got about this. And I am certain it's going to go into formation models that are going to need to explain this. It's all the buzz in the planetary science community.
Hmm. Amazing.
Yeah.
It's full of surprises. Maybe I should also mention the surface is really unexpected as well. It has this unusually smooth surface with mottlings on it. And it has kind of creases and ravines which seem to be filled with some kind of white stuff. And it's really all new, isn't it, Alan? Nobody could have predicted any of this. And nobody really knows yet how this stuff happened, right?
He's absolutely right. You know, just yesterday, I think it was, or if it wasn't, it was Saturday, that I sent an email around the science team. And I'm sure Brian saw this one, in which I challenged and said, I had never seen an object like this. But I said, New Horizons hive mind, who's seen an analog object to these kinds of features that we're seeing on any space mission ever? And really we haven't come up with anything, which is great because it means now we're really onto a big discovery.
It's amazing. I keep telling everyone it's snow. It's a little. This is an object in a snowstorm, right?
Yeah, we have to keep in mind, you know, these images fool your eye. They fool my eye for sure. We see the darker places and then the kinds of bright markings that Brian is describing. But, you know, the dark places are very dark. They're about as reflective as black velvet. They're just a few percent reflective. But even the bright areas, when we do the numbers, are only a couple times more reflective than lunar soil or dirt. So they're not really bright like snow so much as they're just relatively bright, and they fool your eye when you look at them.
Well, now
the albedos range from a few percent, the albedos being the reflectivity, range from just a couple of percent, the darkest places, up to perhaps 15%.
Yeah, this whole thing is like a cinder, darker than a cinder.
You're listening to Blue Dot. After a short break, we'll return to our conversation with Alan Stern and Brian May. Stay with us. And we're back. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Let's get back now to our interview with Queen guitarist and astrophysicist Brian May and Alan Stern, principal investigator of New Horizons and big-time Queen fan. Now that you've had these two amazing encounters at the edge of the solar system, and you've had these metaphorical front-row seats for historic exploration, what's next for New Horizons?
Well, to begin, we have our hands full right now with bringing the data down, which involves lots of planning with the Deep Space Network. And we prioritize every week what we want to get next. We have so much data on the spacecraft that, given our data rates and the way that we share that tracking communications network, it's going to take us through the summer of next year to get it all. So that's a pretty big task. And then every week, new presents arrive from the Kuiper Belt in the form of ones and zeros that make images and spectra and other data types. And I always describe this process that goes on in the science team because new things are arriving each week. I describe it sort of like ER docs. You know, they just triage the patients and then move them on to longer term care. And so we open the packages and we make initial discoveries and see how things compare to what we knew before. And then before you can get very far, new data comes in and you have more. Oh, now it's a color data set. Oh, now it's a stereo data set. Oh, now it's some of the atmospheric information. And so we are, for the foreseeable future, for many months, going to be in that mode. And we're already writing papers and giving scientific talks. And then as we get to having passed halfway, you know, most of the information on the ground, we can start to be more reflective and take the time to do more detailed numerical models and really try to understand how these things came to be, not just understand what these things are, but how they came to be. In the longer term, we have the power and the fuel to fly New Horizons on into the mid-2030s, which is quite a long time, and out to a much greater distance. And it's my fondest hope that we will, with the remaining fuel aboard, be able to do more than just that, but also find another flyby target still farther out. But to do that, we have to propose to NASA. There's an orderly process that takes place every several years called the Planetary Mission Senior Review. And that comes up again next year. So next year we'll propose. And if NASA accepts our proposal, then beginning later in 2020 or in 2021, we'll begin to put together a search for the next flyby target with no guarantee that we'll find it. That depends upon lots and lots of details, including how many things are out there too far to discover from the Earth. So we'll have to use our own telescopes on board, which I think is really cool. That's never been done before. And if we're fortunate, we'll have another flyby in the 2020s sometime.
Amazing.
Well, I'd like to close out asking you both. Usually I ask, what's your favorite thing about being a part of a team like this? But I'd kind of like to turn that around a little bit since I have both of you. I'd like to know from each of you what you most enjoy about each other, about the other person as being part of your team. So, Alan, what's your favorite part about having Brian as a part of the New Horizon team?
I don't think that I can put it down to one thing. And it's a question I've never been asked, but it's a combination of his, he's actually putting his shoulder into it. He's actually, gone way beyond just the guest rock star that sits in, and we'll talk about it at dinner, but he's actually become a seriously working member of the team and making important contributions, like I said earlier on the stereographic analysis. But he has also given us a whole new dimension to the public outreach through this beautiful anthem, New Horizons, that he wrote and produced and played. And he's just such a gracious friend and colleague. It's one great big package. I can't separate those things. They're all wonderful.
And Brian, what's your favorite part about being a part of Alan's team?
Oh, I'm very touched by that. Thank you, Alan. I think I just enjoy watching Alan in action. He is totally unique. And you have this combination of an artist and a scientist to begin with. And I've always thought that the two are necessary for greatness, which is a whole different discussion. But you add to that with Alan, he's a leader. He's a born leader. And his eyes glisten when he's about to issue an order. And people do it because they love it. They love him and they feel inspired by his vision. And the whole team is a reflection of Alan's incredible passion and skill and belief that this is something worthwhile. This is something that humanity should be doing. And damn it, he's right. So that's what I love. I love watching Alan in action. He's like a field marshal of science and art, if you like.
And if I could add to that, as a member of the media interacting with the New Horizons team, and Alan in particular, is I always get this wonderful feeling, whether he's communicating with me on Twitter or via email or having a conversation like this, that I'm important to him at the moment that he's talking to me. And that's a real gift in a leader.
Well, both you gents are too kind. New Horizons is a great big team, and I probably get way too much focus and credit, but thank you both very much.
And it is important to remember that. How big is the team? Give our listeners a sense of how many people work with you on New Horizons.
Well, we're a smaller team in flight than we were when we were building it, because you need these vast armies of engineers and technicians. At the time that we were building New Horizons, 2,500 men and women were working on the project. So it was a big team, at least by my standards. Wow. It's comparable to the biggest particle physics teams, like at CERN, or the team that cracked the human genome, or like, a good-sized company. And then after we launched, we skinny down to about 50 people. Just a small flight crew of engineers and flight controllers and the science team and a few others that flew this baby all the way across the solar system and prepared for the assault, so-called assault, storming the gates of Pluto on Bastille Day. And then as we got near the flyby, we brought in lots more scientific talent. We had to have three shifts of flight controllers and more engineering help. And we bulked up to about 200 people. And then we skinny decked down again in the billion-mile flight out to Ultima Thule. And then we bulked up for that flyby to almost 200 again. And now it's getting smaller. So it varies, but there are about 100 scientists involved in the data analysis on our geology, composition, and plasma atmospheres teams, and then the flight control team and the engineering team. And it's a great group of people. I have worked on 29 spaceflight missions, European Space Agency missions, and NASA missions, and private spaceflight. And we're very fortunate. I think New Horizons is the best team I've ever been involved in, and the most collaborative.
Well, Brian, you know, thinking back to all those many years ago when you and your father were tinkering away to home make that iconic guitar of yours, could you have imagined then that someday you would be involved in the operation of a spacecraft at the edge of the solar system?
No, I think it was beyond my wildest dreams. I often wish my dad was around because he would have loved it. He would have been very proud. You know, he was a good scientist. He was an engineer and a radar operator actually in the war and subsequently. So he would have loved this stuff. And your answer is, I never could have dreamed it. And I'm so happy that I get this opportunity. Just, you know, happy, grateful, and blessed. And I want more. You know, I want to be spared so I see the next one. I want to be there.
Well, Brian May and Alan Stern, it was just a joy to talk to both of you. Alan, as usual, just a lot of fun to listen to you explain to us the wonders of the outer solar system and how you go about exploring it, because it really is mind-boggling what you've achieved.
It certainly is.
Well, thank you on behalf of our team. And David, it was a blast doing this with you. Thanks for the invitation.
And Brian, best of luck at the Oscars with Bohemian Rhapsody.
Thank you very much. Well, our number is in the hat, so we shall see. But it's been an amazing journey, I've got to say. Well, it's not quite 4 billion miles, but it's a long way to come.
You know, if I can just add, there's a famous line I heard somewhere that was sung once, I want it all. Well, you know, I want it all too, and I want that movie and Queen to take a sweep at the Oscars.
Wow. Thank you, Alan. Well, depends who's at the wheel, right?
This is true.
Touché.
Well, from
Brian's at the wheel.
From the fans' perspective here, we're totally with you.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Thank you.
All right, guys. I know Brian's got to go, and I so appreciate you carving out a little time from your busy schedule. I hope you enjoyed it.
It's been great. Thanks so much. And such an honor to do it with Alan, you know, who is a great inspiration to me, I got to say, you know, and a joy in every way. So thank you.
It goes double for me, Brian. Thank you for coming on with me.
Brilliant.
Thanks again to our guests, Brian May from Queen and the New Horizons Science Team, along with his friend, Principal Investigator Alan Stern. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Subscribe to Blue Dot on NPR Podcasts via the NPR One app. We're distributed by PRX. Hey, that's the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Our show is produced and engineered by Mr. Blue Sky Schofield. And our associate producer, owner of a dog named Rocket, is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.